This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. State lawmakers are pushing to change a variety of environmental measures in North Carolina. The Senate voted last week to weaken state environmental regulations, and lawmakers are trying to kill a six-year-old renewable energy policy. Meanwhile, DENR, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, has changed its mission statement to focus on what it calls customer service. Some say it's anti-science. Many of the measures are widening the ideological gap between Republicans and Democrats. Laura Leslie is Capitol Bureau Chief for WRAL News and joins us now by phone to talk about some of these issues. Laura, welcome.
Hi, Frank.
Let's talk about the Regulatory Reform Act. What does that do?
Well, this, we're talking about Senate Bill 612, and this is a bill that would make a whole lot of changes to the way that local officials and state officials regulate environmental concerns. Basically, what it says is that local officials cannot have any regulations or rules on the books about the environment that are stricter than the state's regulations or rules, and the state needs to go back and repeal or rewrite everything that is stricter than the federal guidelines. So, you know, it's called the Hardison Amendment, essentially. It just says that states can't have regulations that are tougher than the feds. Now, the problem with that, obviously, as opponents will point out, is that, you know, North Carolina is a really geographically and geologically diverse state. You know, we've got mountains on one end and the coast on the other, you know, and different communities say they have different needs, you know, for example, protecting water supplies in Charlotte or addressing stormwater runoff in the big flat areas in the counties up by the coast. Those kind of ordinances would pretty much be out of the question unless they went to the courts to get a judge to say that they were okay, or unless they could prove that they were dealing with a, quote, serious and unforeseen threat to public health. But, I mean, we can foresee heavy rain, right? We can foresee coastal flooding.
Well, presumably that's why those regulations were written in the first place, that those localities foresaw those events and wrote the regulations that, folks said they wanted.
Exactly. Well, Raleigh's another example, for example. We have problems with the sewer system here in Raleigh. It's sort of not keeping up with the growth, and we have problems with clogs. So we have special rules here about putting oil and grease down the sewer because we have overflows every so often when it gets clogged up. Like that, for example, would be the sort of local ordinance that would, you know, possibly be in danger under this bill.
So you can see the logic of having stricter bills than the federal mandates. Those would be, I mean, anytime you're writing a regulation for the whole of the United States of America, that would be the baseline. And then, as you say, the localities have to fine-tune it, often strengthening those regulations. So why do state lawmakers say they have to be weakened?
Well, you know, for years, localities have gone on making their own rules, and sometimes, you know, especially developers will tell you, real estate folks and, you know, commercial developers will tell you that you know, they're too much, you know, that it gets to be too expensive keeping up with all these rules. Some of them don't seem to be necessary, and they're not always enforced, correctly or consistently across the state. So, you know, I think it's kind of a pendulum swing. You know, for years we had Democrats in charge, and DENR and locals sort of went on their, you know, their way of making these rules up, and some people think they went too far, you know. But, I mean, you know, if you roll everything back to the federal guidelines, you know, it's a lot cheaper to lobby that, to keep that under control if you're a lobbyist. It's cheaper to lobby Congress to control environmental regulations in all 50 states or 30 or, you know, whatever has adopted this kind of guideline versus having to go to each of those state legislatures and fight every individual battle.
Well, and what is it? I mean, I'm trying to get the logic here. So they're saying that businesses may impede business development in North Carolina if our regulations are too strict. In other words, businesses won't come here if we have strict regulations, environmental regulations. They want weaker regulations.
Well, and that's the argument, is that it's business unfriendly. Of course, now, you know, the state's rankings and business selection magazines, you know, basically seem to counterpoint that. But, you know, the idea is that if they make it too hard for businesses to grow, to build, then they'll go somewhere with weaker regulations. And a lot of the states in the Southeast do have weaker regulations than North Carolina.
Interesting if you say that you have to degrade your environment in order to attract business, kind of what the trade-off is. And I guess that's the thing they're wrestling with right now in the legislature. So let's talk about the another subject now, an attempt to end North Carolina's renewables policy, a six-year-old policy. Tell us what it is and why they'd like to change it.
Well, they're not trying to end it completely, but they are trying to pull out of it set aside, basically, a subsidy for solar power. And this was called the REPS portfolio. It passed in 2007, and it said that utility companies in North Carolina have to get a certain percentage of the power that they sell from alternative energy sources. So, you know, that includes wind, it includes hydro, it includes biofuels, Even pig poop and chicken manure, burned can or can generate methane that can be used. So in the 6 years since we got that, actually North Carolina's sort of been booming in the alternative energy industry, and we're actually, I think, the fifth biggest solar state in the country at this point. So it is a little surprising that suddenly there's a move afoot to do away with these subsidies, because they have actually generated a lot of investment and jobs. And you know, I think it's especially puzzling for the rural areas, because you hear a lot about how economic development tends to focus on the urban areas of the state and it misses the rural parts, right?
Right.
Well, with solar, the rural parts actually have an advantage because their land is cheaper. And, you know, the counties are happy to have them come in. You know, so we hear a lot about these projects that are going up in these rural counties. And we've heard quite a few rural county officials come in and say, please don't do this, because this is creating jobs in our community.
Well, so brings economic development to underserved areas, encourages business to grow in the state, which is what they said they were worried about with tougher environmental regulations. Why are they opposed to this?
Well, that's a really good question. The only people that we've really heard speaking up about this are the folks from the sort of right-wing libertarian think tanks, especially Americans for Prosperity, which seems to be the chief sort of antagonist against the solar power stuff.
They're up there in Arlington, Virginia, right?
Well, yeah. But, I mean, we have a state chapter as well. People who are critics of AFP, of course, will point out that they are funded by the Koch brothers, who make their money on petroleum and don't necessarily want alternative energy to become cheaper and more readily available. Now, whether or not that's actually the answer, I'm sure they would disagree. They say that they feel like we're subsidizing the solar industry to the detriment of other industries, and that people should have the choice to subsidize or not subsidize solar if they want to, but people shouldn't be forced to do that.
And it is creating something of a rift in the Republican Party. It's failed a few times in committee in the House, has it not?
Yeah, well, it failed in the Senate, too, but they still passed it through. It failed in a House committee, and members of the senior leadership of the Republican House caucus voting against Mike Hager, the sponsor, who's also the minority whip. So that was kind of a big deal. And then they tried to run it in the Senate last week, and they had it in a Senate Finance Committee, and it was a companion bill, the same bill on the Senate side. And they pronounced it to have passed, but actually Mark Binker and I went through, and you can find the story in NC Capitol. We called the members of the committee and asked them how they voted, and the answer is it didn't pass.
Wow, so they did it on a voice vote, and there was actually an outcry among Democrats. I think that was the famous Banana Republic claim that we should have, in fact, a vote count, because the voice vote wasn't that clear?
Exactly, and that count, it's called count for division. They want to basically count some hands, was ignored by the Senate chairman. So we had to make phone calls because we couldn't get a count.
So it actually lost in the Senate but got through because, well, they're in charge. And Mike Hager is the committee chairman in the House. It's failed. He keeps bringing that up. Are there rules about this? How many times can he bring it to the committee?
Well, you can keep it. What happens is the committee takes up what's called a proposed committee substitute. So he can keep coming back with new versions of it as long as he wants to. Now, you don't often see that. It's sort of not done when the leadership of your own caucus has said we're not in favor of this bill. But I think he's just thinking that if he can fine-tune it and get enough people on board, that maybe he can swing a vote. And you got to remember, we're coming up on crossover next week, and that's the witching hour at the legislature every 2 years, at which pretty much every bill that's going to be handled for the next year and a half has to have gotten through one or the other chamber. So this is when you see a lot of sort of desperate, sometimes inventive moves to get legislation into that bin so that it can be considered.
Got to talk to you about Diener's mission statement. The Department of Environment and Natural Resources changed its mission statement, and that's caused a controversy. What's going on there?
Well, Governor McCrory, when he was on the campaign trail, said that he really wants state government to focus on customer service. And I think so part of the change in that mission statement reflects that. Of course, the question that critics point out is, who is the customer? Is it business that they're trying to serve here, or is it the public? Because, the question is that really a customer service agency, or should it actually be regulating, making sure that those of us who have to breathe the air and drink the water are being kept safe? Another part of the mission statement that rose made some eyebrows go up, I should say, had to do with how it handles science. Talked about a broad diversity of opinion. It doesn't really address what happens when you have things that are pretty much unanimous among sort of, the peer-reviewed publishing scientific community. And there's some concern that this is a way for Diener to sort of ignore science that it doesn't like and bring in folks that would agree with it in order to sort of say, well, there, we got two sides to this, so there's a controversy here. We don't have an answer, so we can't take action on things like, say, climate change.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that. One more I've got to talk to you about, a piece of legislation. I want to make sure I've got this right. You are there every day, so let me make sure I've got it. Legislation that would prevent government buildings from being LEED certified, meaning environmentally good LEED certified buildings.
Yes, that is coming up in committee this afternoon, actually. And it basically says that state buildings shouldn't be seeking LEED certification. That's the low energy, that's energy efficiency standards.
Yeah.
Because LEED doesn't use a credit system that gives certification for North Carolina lumber.
Okay.
So it's called the Protect Promote NC Lumber Act.
I see. Well, we will we'll stay tuned to that as well. Laura, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Frank.
On the State of Things today, talking about various pieces of legislation relating to the environment, Laura Leslie, Capitol Bureau Chief for WRAL News. Just ahead, we're going to hear from some of those people involved in the trenches fighting over environment. You're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're talking about changes to environmental protection here in North Carolina. Joining us now is John Sclavara. He is Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Frank. Happy to be here.
We talked about this in our first segment, changes to Diener's mission statement. Tell us about that. How'd that come about, and what are the changes?
The changes are quite simple. We are going to continue to protect the environment with an attitude that we're going to focus on fundamental customer service, fundamental economics, and fundamental science.
Who's the customer?
The customer is the taxpayers of North Carolina, everybody.
So there's this controversy over this variety of opinions that's going to make its way into the decision-making process. And there are some who say, well, it's science isn't really about opinions, and there's a variety, but many are minority opinions. How are you going to weigh that? How do you talk about the prevalent scientific view versus minority objections? How are you going to weigh that?
What did Albert Einstein say about consensus science? He said that all these consensus scientists should substitute their giant brain for a giant spine, because the reality is there is no such thing as consensus science.
So how do you act? I mean, the question is...
Well, it's very simple. It's very simple.
Yeah.
Diener is a community of science. It would be absolutely inappropriate for me to establish policy that says, I'm going to go draw the target on the wall, and now it's up to you to draw the rings around the bullseye. I'm going to go draw the bullseye, and you draw the rings around. The science will go where our scientists take it. All that we have asked at Diener is that they be fully versed on all points of view. You know, kind of like a university is supposed to be a community of ideas.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what happens on...
Our scientists will make the decision. Our scientists will make the call.
Right, but I mean, based on what? For instance, in some quarters, there is still a controversy over climate change. The preponderance of scientific evidence and the fact at this moment can be overturned tomorrow. But the fact at this moment is that human activity, particularly burning hydrocarbon fuels, is creating catastrophic or dramatic, if not catastrophic, climate change. Now, if you're going to have to base a policy on the belief in that or not, or do you say, well, we have to wait till all the evidence is in? I mean, how are you going to do that? Because there is a minority view, but
Frank, I disagree with you. I'm not sure there's a minority or a majority view. All I'm saying to our scientists is, once the decision is made, you will assure me that you have looked at all points of view and come to a conclusion. If in fact they go with the majority view.
It is a majority view.
If there's,
yeah.
Well, but
it is. No, it really is.
Frank,
it really, really is.
I'll bet you are not versed in all the schools of thought. But if you are or not, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
My only point is that our scientists have to convince me that they have looked, researched, and understood all points of view, and from that they will make a conclusion wherever the science leads.
Mm.
It is not my job to draw the bullseye on the wall and say, here's where we're going to get, because as a non-scientist, it's not appropriate for me.
But now this is, I mean, this department really relies on scientific information, and the director,
sure
it seems to me, needs to. I mean, for instance, let me talk to you about this, because we just had Laura Leslie on, and I know you did an interview with her. And I want you to listen to this, because I think during that interview you said that you thought that oil might be a renewable resource. Let's listen.
You know, I'm thinking about what you're saying about natural gas, and that's true. You know, obviously it's very cheap right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, you know, on the flip side, it's a finite resource and a fossil resource.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there...
There's some people who disagree with you on that. The Russians, for instance, have always drilled oil as if it's a renewable resource, and so far they haven't been proven wrong. There's a lot of different scientific opinion on that.
Is oil a renewable resource?
Not my call, Frank. I told you. All my point was to Laura is that she said gas is a finite resource. And I said, Laura, there are schools of thought that take a different point of view than emphatically saying oil is or gas is a finite resource. I didn't say what the answer was. I said, Laura, there are other schools of thought. She was not aware of that.
How do you resolve that?
It's for dean or scientist to resolve. That's the point. All I want is dean or scientist to understand that there are other opinions out there. It's tough calls. It's difficult. But
right.
It is not my job to say one or the other is correct. I'm not going to draw the bullseye on the wall and say it's a finite resource. If you determine it's a finite resource, at least convince me that you have listened to other scientific points of view. All I'm saying, I'm not telling you what the answer is. You tell me what the answer is. Just be thoroughly versed, just like a university environment is supposed to be, right?
Right. John, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Sklar, Secretary of North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources. Joining us now, Jonathan Reel. He is a communications consultant. He teaches communication studies at Wake Technical Community College. And he wrote an op-ed May 1st on Diener's mission statement, along with a co-author, Scott Faulkner. And Jonathan joins us now. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks, sir.
Also with us, Dallas Woodhouse, North Carolina director of the Virginia-based Americans for Prosperity. His group is one of those advocating for an end to North Carolina's renewables policy. Dallas Woodhouse, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Jonathan, let me ask you, because you wrote the op-ed, and I know that you don't agree with the change in that mission statement. What is it you don't like about it?
Well, I think it's we just heard kind of an expose of what's going on within the Republican Party and conservatism in general when it comes to not just regulation overall, but particularly views on science. And my co-author, Scott, and I come from different generations and different political perspectives. He's further to the right than I am, but part of what a lot of folks, including Scott, have been very frustrated with is the kind of filibustering that we just heard from your previous guest from Diener on the nature of what science is.
Well, look, what he's saying is there's a lot of different views. He wants a scientist. He wants to make sure that you've read all the opinions, including minority views, and digested those before you come up with a policy. It sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it?
Well, only if there is something to contest in that science is not about endless debate over situations where we have 99% of the field agreeing on one thing and 1% objecting, saying that the Earth is still flat. The verdict is in on these things. And what we see in the redrafting of the mission statement is probably a very strategic opening of the door to more radical elements of the Republican Party that want to contest, as you were asking him, want to contest global warming, want to even contest something, as you asked him about whether oil is a renewable resource. These ideas that have no place in respected science, and whether you're on the left or the right or in the middle, these things shouldn't be up for grabs. And the fact that they're getting written into policy is deeply disturbing to folks of. It should be deeply disturbing to folks of all political stripes.
Well, Dallas Woodhouse, is it disturbing to you? What's your take on this mission statement?
I think they've got it exactly right. Look, I think you had guests here today and I believe the host has a very different point of view when it comes to the regulatory scheme that the state ought to enact, because the reality on this climate change hocus pocus is even if the climate is changing, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And what kind of punishment do we want to put on North Carolina taxpayers, and how do we want to regulate human beings to address something that there's no evidence that one state can affect? That's why it's global climate change if things exist. And so what we're talking about in a number of these areas is deregulating human beings and human activity. I don't have a problem with solar farms, but just like when you go to the zoo, they tell you not to feed the bears. Let these people create a product that can compete in the marketplace that doesn't make unwilling ratepayers send them money every month, you know, by a surcharge on their power bill, which is the way it's done now. And it infuriates me that the left is willing to punish poor people in North Carolina with higher energy costs so that they can subsidize multinational corporations who are, you know, getting subsidies for solar power or whatever. I think it's really morally offensive.
Well, Jonathan, you know, your co-author with that op-ed is Scott Faulkner, a former personnel director in the Reagan-Bush administration, also worked for Newt Gingrich. So a lot of conservative credentials here. How do you and he feel about what Dallas just said?
Well, I take strong exemption to what he just said, because there's a civil war going on in the Republican Party and in the conservative movement right now. And Dallas is on the losing side. American for Prosperity is to borrow a phrase from the bad old days, is an outside agitator group. Even Duke Power does not endorse the removal of the solar power provisions that are currently on the table.
It is interesting that Duke Energy has
I spoke to them today. And they have a very carefully worded statement. In 2007, they were partners in putting that together. And so the Tea Party, Koch Brothers faction of the conservative movement right now is at war with the longer legacy of the conservative movement, which my friend Scott is a part of. And their takeover, you know, they had their high point when they poured millions of dollars into races in 2010 and helped the Republicans take the House of Representatives. But their millions went wasted in 2012. But to see this kind of thing happening in our state is very disappointing. And to have this kind of inflammatory rhetoric, which actually goes against the long-standing Republican legacy of conservation, which dates back to Teddy Roosevelt, who established the National Park Service for the protection of natural resources, to Richard Nixon, who founded the EPA. We're seeing a sea change here, and I think it's important for viewers to listen to the language that's being used.
Dallas, what do you think about it? Let's just talk about that this really doesn't – I mean, if you talk about – let's take a look at one of the bills that has passed in the legislature, the idea that localities cannot decide for themselves what kind of regulations they would like to impose on the air they breathe and the water they drink. Now, you said you don't want to impose restrictions on individuals to take away their freedom. The state just did that to localities and said you have to let the federal government impose those regulations, and you can't make them any stiffer.
Well, that's right. You have to remember that the municipalities are creation of the state, just as the federal government is a creation of the state, and the state has a reasonable overlook here. Look, it is our view that North Carolina is overly regulated. Now, look, Republicans, conservatives, my children, we drink water, we breathe air, we have no intention of making it dirty, but some of these regulations are nonsensical, they're outdated, and it is unfair for people trying to create business or start a job or work for themselves to have to go through a massive, you know, minefield of different regulations from town to town. There needs to be some consistency, there needs to be some fairness. Look, we are looking at lots of ways to deregulate. And what I think you'll see is more of the approach that's taken by the North Carolina Labor Department under the administration of Commissioner Barry over the last few years. It's not like they stopped investigating workplace safety, but they work with businesses to try to make them safe, keep workers safe, but rather than looking for ways to punish them, which I think is what one thing Diener has done throughout the years. I mean, you know, look, Diener is something that conservatives want to reform, and we're going to do it.
When you talked about the localities, you know, that there should be some conformity and uniformity. I mean, isn't there a problem? And wouldn't, you know, folks in the mountains are going to say, well, we don't have the same problems they have on the coastal plain. We've got to write our own regulations. And if they become onerous and we notice we're chasing business away, can't we, the locality, make that choice? But don't we have the right to figure out what's local to the mountains and not to the coastal plain?
Well, as a matter of fact, under the state constitution, they do not. Now, what they can do is go to the legislature and ask the legislature to enact a measure that at least covers some, you know, territory, you know, that's defined other than city to city. I mean, but, you know, we do not have home rule in North Carolina. It's completely the prerogative of the General Assembly.
What about, let's talk to you, and I'll stick with you, Dallas, the idea of renewables. You mentioned it, the idea that we're paying a little bit more on our energy bill now to promote the renewable energy industry, which has been pretty profitable.
You call it little. I didn't say little.
All right. I will say you have to pay more. You have to pay more for energy to promote the renewable energy business, which is starting to grow and prosper in North Carolina.
Well, it's only prospering because of subsidies. If we're prospering, they wouldn't be trying to take money out of people's pockets every month to subsidize it. I mean, you know, this is the same reason you don't feed the bears at the zoo, because you don't want them to become dependent. It's the same thing. These people need to get off the subsidies. Now, one of the big wind engine companies in America recently said that the subsidies are hurting the business because they're not innovating and changing and revolutionizing the way they need to be competitive.
Jonathan, what about that? If there's an industry here to be had, if there's money to be made, if there's a desire for this in a market, why are we having to help them? Why aren't there people out there making wind farms and solar farms without government help?
Well, there's studies and there's studies. I've talked to people who have worked in the solar industry in this state for decades who have very different opinions. And you know, I suspect that the study Dallas is referring to was the Pope Foundation funded, but the overall message that we're hearing is actually, I just want to bring it back to the fact that you know, the point of view we're hearing is a far right Tea Party.
Yeah, I mean, wherever it comes from, Jonathan, however it was formed, what's the logic? Is there an argument to be made for a market based industry that lets, if we can see, and by the way, it is a fact that oil is not a renewable resource, fact. So, but it's not. And therefore, if you know that we're getting close to peak oil, we're getting close to a time when we're going to run out, well, what the heck? Make yourself a wind farm and make some money, right? Why do I need a subsidy for that?
And that's also part of what some of us think is actually the true nature of conservatism, is that we're conserving what we have, and we're thinking about the future. You know, to go back to the roots of what the Republican Party once was and what conservatism once was, it was to take the long view and not the short one. And so we're not thinking about quarterly profits. We're thinking about future generations. And if in the short term that does mean that belts need to be tightened and incentives needs to be placed into the tax code, and federalism actually needs to be allowed to operate, and federalism is a core conservative principle, which Dallas seems to be rejecting right now and denying localities the authority to make their own regulations based upon their own certain circumstances, then I'm not sure where we're at in terms of what the overall policy is going to be. But certainly from a traditional conservative perspective, we want to think about what future generations are going to inherit from us and what the resources are, and incentivize development of things that are going to serve our children and our grandchildren well.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think, Dallas, the market argument is a compelling one, but then there are markets and markets. So if somebody puts in a pizzeria and there's a line out the door, that's a signal to the market that we need more pizzerias, and I don't need a subsidy to tell me that. The thing with energy is, and I think what some folks are saying, is the signal to the market might be a crisis. And the question is, do we want to wait till we get to the crisis point to begin the development, or should we, as a matter of prudence, put a few dollars away now, or even a lot of dollars away if you would rather, in order not to reach that crisis point? What about that argument?
I mean, I think this whole business that we're going to run out of oil, economists will tell you that'll never happen because the price will go up. You know, I don't believe we're in a crisis. We're actually in an energy boom if we could just tap our natural gas resources. The thing to do, we believe the policy should be of the General Assembly is to guarantee an ample supply of energy to North Carolina residents, citizens, and business at the absolute lowest cost. Anything more than that, we believe the market ought to take care of it. And your other guest talked about what's left behind. I remind you what was left behind from the previous governor and the Democrat legislature: double-digit unemployment, stagnation, and economic misery. And we are going to get North Carolina working again, and we're going to do it by cutting taxes, cutting regulations, and becoming more business-friendly in North Carolina. We're still going to protect the environment, but that's what we're going to do. We don't do it the way the other people do it and just put everybody on the government dole, digging ditches and filling them back in. This
right.
job
Dallas.
Was-
now, Dallas, you know that this state did not put – it was. You do remember 2008, don't you? That's the double-digit, right, unemployment. Okay.
We thoroughly believe that the policies adopted, which became high tax rates and high regulation, are affecting unemployment now. We believe that, and we're going to pursue that in a way to change the state. We tax higher than our neighbors. Every other state has lower income tax rates than North Carolina, and we believe it hurts.
We're more
regulated.
Thank you very much. Dallas Woodhouse, North Carolina Director of the Virginia-based Americans for Prosperity, and Jonathan Reel, Communications Consultant, teaches Communication Studies at Wake Technical Community College. Thank you both. Coming up, Barbecue Man Unleashed on the state of things. Finally, on to some serious stuff. Here we go.